Michael, hello. The weekend went well?
Yes, it did, actually. It went very well for the family here. And what about yourself?
Yeah, I went down to the Yacht Club and did a bit of a cover story on that on Saturday. I was going to go back Sunday, but I just did housekeeping instead, mate. So, yeah.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, dedicated.
Yes, indeed.
Now, Michael, welcome to the show. Your book, Unbound Justice, is the first novel in the Sandstone trilogy, I believe, which spans 37 years in Sydney, I guess, in the 19th century. What led you to writing this book?
Thanks, Greg. I think basically that the period that I chose was a big leap in the colony's development. I sort of picked it because I wanted it to be the second book right in the middle of the Gold Rush, which is about 1850-51, and that had a monumental effect on it. The primitive period of the colony, especially New South Wales, was a fairly ordinary affair from 1788 to 1810. It was full of internecine politics and so forth and a big struggle. So I just selected that 1850 to 1885 period as being sort of, I thought, a sweet spot within the activity of the colony and also the way the building industry sort of took off in a big way.
Yeah, look, we'll talk about that in a moment too, Michael. I think you've given yourself a nice frame there to work within because, of course, you mentioned that it was the Gold Rush. I think back then Sydney was really a city that was fired to the Gold Rush and I guess dedicated to creating some of the finest buildings in the colony. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. I mean, post Greenway, who was a convict architect, there was a few Mortimer Lewis and Barnett and so forth that came after that. But I guess Macquarie was a big stimulant too in terms of the public buildings rather than the housing itself.
Yeah, he did well, as governor,
And I think he did a lot historically, but he did a great job. But at the time, he was right in the depths of politics. And what I have to remember and keep reminding myself as a writer is the fact that, not like today with our social media, everything was very slow in lots of respects. Just getting around was one, and actually communication. And it took about 4 to 6 months to get anything back from England in terms of what they were allowed to do in the colony. So it was pretty grim.
So I guess you spoke about Francis Greenway and the first substantial buildings, I think, but then they had, the Neo-Gothic and the Victorian era too. So it was all sort of a mix of things happening, really, wasn't it, after that period?
Well, that's right. The classical buildings tended to be in the commercial buildings like the courts and so forth and the churches and what have you. And the Neo-Gothic or the Gothic revivals were in the houses. That was basically in the 1880s, I guess, onwards. And a lot of that reflected, Queen Victoria had a huge impact. And, of course, when Albert died, the interesting fact was that the city was in mourning and they weren't allowed to have ostentatious clothing. So they actually put it in their buildings. Now, hence, you see a lot of the Grecian urns and vases on top of parapets and all that sort of thing.
Is that right? Is that how it came about, Michael?
Yes, it was. Jeez. The ostentation. Couldn't be put in clothing or jewellery. You couldn't wear anything like that because of period of mourning. So the effect of the Prince Consort's death was a big impact on Australia and New South Wales.
Yeah, incredible stuff. And I guess in this book, which is the first of three, John, you use the character of John Leary leaving Ireland, I think, in about 1850, and he was a young carpenter, this character in the book, ambitious for a new life in Australia. So you've used these characters that are really, they draw you into the book, and you've used that as a backbone or as part of the backbone to tell this wonderful story about architecture and the building industry in general.
Right. It is what it is. I tried to use historic data as much as I could just to give a flavour of the colony also some buildings as well, including mostly churches. You can probably guess my faith from those from the book, but that's pretty strong.
No go. Do you have Irish ancestry, Michael?
Yes, I do. From Dublin, County Dublin, village called Rush. And that came out in 1863, and my great-grandfather settled in Millers Point in Sydney. The house is still there, and so it's all one family in terms of our connection. It's semi-autobiographical in terms of the story. However, I've just chosen a different county than the one I came from, so forgive me for that.
No, that's fine. You've got to cover your footsteps somehow, even if it's only with a little paint over, but that's wonderful. I guess the serving of the public by the building industry in general, we'll just touch on in a minute, but what about the lifting of height restrictions post-World War II? That had a gigantic effect on Sydney's architecture.
It did indeed, and the biggest sort of influence on that, Greg, was the elevator. the elevator enabled people to get to higher levels than they would normally have been able to do. And that was one of the big impacts on sort of high-rise buildings, and as well as the fire safety. So in the last book of the trilogy, I cover off the building of the Imperial Hotel, and that was obviously a fictional building of 16 stories, but it could have been built with the technology at the time. So it was a big influence in terms of... And of course, the property of Sydney became very expensive. In one instance, I've actually got a price that Wentworth actually bought a block of land for £70 in 1825,
wow.
and he sold it 5 years later for £1,250.
Wow.
So in terms of... We've visited sort of the extraordinary rates of land growth in the past. It's not a new thing. It's sort of occurred all the time.
Yeah, and the expensiveness of Sydney in that regard continues too, so that's interesting.
it does. But there was... Adelaide is one city that's benefited enormously from, I guess, the learning curve of Sydney. And it was the first town centre that was actually laid out with a proper plan, a very, very good plan. And from what I gather, from what my research is, that it hasn't really been visited since Walter Burley Griffin designed Canberra.
Yeah.
So that was the best sort of town plan. So, Melbourne to a lesser extent, but Adelaide certainly benefited. So it was, Sydney just grew from, just basically the topography of the inlet just grew and then sort of expanded from there.
It made its own rules, basically, didn't it?
It did indeed, yes.
So I guess the history of the building industry in Australia, has it served Australians well?
Look, I think it has. I think it's been a quite sort of supplier of need. People, I guess you could liken it in some respects to labour pains. People sort of build a house once in their life or twice in their life. They go through actual hell and agony, and they say they'll never do it again. Once it's finished, everyone's happy. But during that process, there's a monumental amount of work required. And a lot of the things in Australia, the cavity wall, for example, is one where you have two, the inside wall and outside wall, and the outside wall of a building. Was an Australian first to actually create a waterproof wall. So there's a lot of things in there that there are Australian sort of innovations. But I think in terms of, and I dare say that I'll probably be pilloried for this comment, but I dare say that the productivity and the inventions in the last 60 or 70 years really haven't sort of grown exponentially in what they could have in terms of materials, what is available. We're still sort of putting a brick upon a brick and knocking frames together and so forth.
Yeah.
I don't really think that there's been that innovation that really could have happened. And I guess that's for a lot of reasons, economic and political, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so too, Michael. Innovation-wise, I mean, after World War II, when we had, a lot of the buildings, I guess, particularly if we go back to Sydney for just a moment, with the sandstone buildings that were wiped away, a lot of them because of the modern buildings that went up in their place, there were a lot of architects that were quite brilliant that contributed to what Sydney now looks like, even the taller buildings.
Yeah, well, that's quite true. In my own experience, I was with the Lend Lease Group for 10 years, and I'd met Harry Seidel on a number of occasions, and he was obviously instrumental in his particular architectural flair and type of building. He built a multi-story building just about every capital of Australia. But the early 1960, the tallest building at the time was a 10-story building, and that was the Australia Hotel in the MLC Centre, which is now the MLC Centre. And that wasn't eclipsed until the AMP building in 1960, I think it was, 64, which was about 22-storey, and that was huge for the time. And that was Peddlethorpe and Walker architects, and some of those are still around, Bates Smart and others from Melbourne. They're still practising and still have the innovation. So
there had been, from the early days, some manipulation to do with the building industry in Australia, and I guess a continuum of that through the years. What was that all about?
Well, it's a matter of... matter of record from the early days that the tenders that were submitted, there was collusion amongst builders, that whoever put the right sort of price in would be awarded the project. There was a lot of instances of that. I guess it's still a business. It's a very hard business in terms of the competitiveness of the industry. But there are various grades of builders. The master builders came in about the 1870s, and they formed an association from the Builders and Contractors Association. So they're basically carpenter-driven. They sort of grew up as carpenters and became commercial builders. And a lot of early architects were builders themselves. The industry's grown. There is still that fight, and there's still very high risk. There's builders and developers that are still going broke, as they were in the 19th century, as they did now.
Okay. Michael, each capital city, each regional, not so much, but let's look at capital cities around Australia for just a moment. Each one is determined the psyche of its history and its buildings. Does the buildings reflect obviously what was happening in the cities at the time, but each one is so different. Each city of Australia, Brisbane, Sydney, not so much Canberra, but Adelaide, Melbourne, Hobart and Perth even, tell a different story. It's like siblings, united but so different.
Yes, well that's correct. And I guess that follows the growth of the colonies from, you know, New South Wales went from Port Phillip up to Cape York one stage, and then the Victoria first, and then Queensland and so forth. So they all sort of represented the area of population at the time. And let's remember that the distances were enormous, I mean, to travel. They virtually, as you said, sort of started as the cities in their own right, quite isolated from the rest of the country, because the only way to travel was virtually on very ordinary roads or by steam packet.
Sydney is actually probably a reflection. The buildings of life in Sydney is a bit more glitzy than Melbourne. Melbourne is a bit more conservative. Well, I suppose Sydney's architecture was conservative too there, but appealing and very well built. Fine buildings, but conservative. And accomplished buildings, yeah.
Accomplished buildings. Well, the Gold Rush, I mean, it's staggering the sort of money that was around in the Gold Rush period. And people who were labourers were sort of millionaires overnight. And they built buildings. They literally put up magnificent buildings just because they had the money, and they were just ostentatious because they wanted to show people the wealth that they'd garnered. And I guess whereas other capitals had different sort of dynamics and they grew accordingly, I think it's in terms of going up and the density of certain areas, I think that's a population based thing, and I think that hasn't changed.
That's right. Very, very true. There are natural drawbacks to Perth, its distance, Adelaide, but then of course Melbourne and Sydney tend to generate the most income and the most, I guess, excitement as far as those buildings go. So, yeah, most well said. Michael, your book, Unbound Justice, as I said before, it's the first in the Sandstone trilogy. John Leary, don't want to give away too many secrets, but we look forward to seeing what happens through the three books and with your expertise in the area. What led you to writing this? If you could tell listeners about your background in this industry.
Oh, thanks, Greg. I've been about 40 years in the construction industry. I got a degree in applied science from UTS University. I started with a company called AV Jennings, who you may or may not remember.
Indeed.
And went up through the ranks, did my cadetship in the construction industry, and basically picked up working for project managers. And then I've worked overseas. I worked in Bangkok and Ho Chi Minh City in terms of running construction companies over there as construction manager. And I've actually worked with government for about 6 years in both of the customs house renovation in Sydney, which was a major restoration, and also restored parts of town hall. So there were parts of my career that I just wanted to sort of inquire about. I hadn't been there before, hadn't stepped into that particular sort of area. So I just found jobs that would actually give me a new challenge. And the last part, before I got into writing full-time, I was looking after a mining accommodation services company. We're building mining villages all around Australia in the peak of the mining boom.
Okay.
So it's a love of construction, it's a love of design, it's and a passion for Sydney. And I found that my facility for writing was I found it, when I say easy, it's hard to write a novel, but I just wanted to put all that three together in the mix.
It's another thoughtful, insightful observation of Australia during a period which was, for all its rough and tumble, a very exciting time. And we certainly thank you once again for taking the time to speak with us.
That's great, Greg. I appreciate it.